Greetings and welcome to another episode of the Speak Hurts podcast, a show where I talk to my favorite producers, mixers, and artists about the work that they do. Today's guest is none other than Dan Wilson, a renowned songwriter who initially had success in the 90s with his band Semisonic that peaked in 1998 with their hit single Closing Time. Once the early 2000s came around, Dan shifted focus to writing for other artists and soon became known for collaborations with the likes of the Dixie Chicks, Pink, James Morrison, Weezer, Jason Mraz, Leon Bridges, Taylor Swift, and Adele. Dan and I talked about his career from the 80s until now, how he ended up in the room with some of these artists, and what his studio setup looks like. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, regarding your first band, Trip Shakespeare, how did you guys get signed to A&M? That was for Across the Universe, I believe.
Yes. Trip Shakespeare had been touring the Midwest for a couple of years. Our booking agent basically put us on a really intense and pretty repetitive schedule throughout the Midwest. Like every 2 months, we'd pass through all the same towns again, and it was all within like 500 miles of us, kind of. And we got to the point where in Minneapolis and in other places nearby, we had a lot of fans who were really, really kind of crazy and into it. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was like a review type of show with lots and lots of artists in Minneapolis. And it might've been the Minnesota Music Awards and it might've been something else, but Trip Shakespeare, we sang an a cappella song, one of our songs a cappella. And by chance, there were a whole bunch of record people there, label people. I don't know if they were there to see somebody else, but suddenly we were on the radar of a bunch of people from New York and a couple from LA who worked at labels. And there was a lawyer in Minneapolis, I'm probably getting this story somewhat wrong, but Larry Osterman, who asked if we wanted help kind of representing us to the labels, and particularly to the ones who were at the show and got all excited. So over the course of maybe, I think, a year, essentially, we kept doing the shows exactly as we were doing. And then Larry would convince various of his friends in the business to go see us in Kansas City or Chicago or whatever it was. And then eventually a couple of the labels expressed interest in signing us. And that's how we ended up signing with A&M.
And what was the typical recording setup for Trip Shakespeare albums back then? Did you have local Minneapolis studios that you targeted to record at, or were you taking advantage of the sort of home recording possibilities that had come along at that point?
You know, it's funny because we were sort of at the beginning of the possibility of home recording that sounded as good as we wanted it to. I would say we made some of our best recordings with a four-track rig in my brother Matt's basement, because we had a whole setup for the band to play. And we'd play live onto a couple tracks, and then we would add vocals or whatever else that we wanted to on the other two tracks. And I thought we made some really good recordings there, but the label folks, they couldn't really imagine that those were actual recordings. They could only imagine that those were demos, no matter how good they were. And in fact, I think sometimes they were better than the things we made as masters, but no one could conceptually get their heads around the idea that the demo might be better than the master at that point. So we ended up doing something which was maybe pretty great also, which is we would go to Cannon Falls, Minnesota, and record in this studio called Pachyderm, which was kind of a passion project of a guy who is from Minnesota. Eventually it was owned by John Cooker, who's a Minnesota legend of recording. So Trip Shakespeare recorded a bunch at Pachyderm in this lovely, big, tall, well-lit live room with windows all over the place, and got some of our recordings there. And that was a great way to do it too.
So once by the way, Wikipedia, the longstanding arbiter of what's true and false in the public realm, they list your instruments as vocals, bass, guitar, keyboards, and drums. I guess they're trying to say that you play everything, but how much of that is true?
I've played all those instruments on lots of records, but I can't play anything with a bow, and I can't play anything with a mouthpiece. I can't play a horn, and I don't do woodwinds. So I don't really play everything. I play all the rhythm section stuff. And I started out as a bass player. I was obsessed with Jaco Pastorius, from Weather Report. And so I learned how to play fretless bass, and I really did have this dream of being finding some fusion-y band and playing the part of Jaco Pastorius, but it didn't work out that way.
So once Semisonic was formed, what studios did you guys record at in the 90s for Great Divide, Feeling Strangely Fine, and All About Chemistry?
Actually, this is relevant to your first question. The first Semisonic record was called the Pleasure EP, and that was a set of songs that John and Jake and I had recorded in our rehearsal space with gear borrowed from John Cooker. John Cooker was a instrument collector and recording gear collector and a musician around town. And he had this plan of starting a studio downtown Minneapolis. But while he was still working on it and finding the space and building it out and so on, he lent us a bunch of microphones and maybe a couple of preamps. And we recorded all the songs that eventually got us signed to Elektra. That was recorded with the band. We did some where we all played live, but Jacob played real cymbals and drum sampling pads and recorded those tracks of the MIDI samples. And then we replaced those drums with sampler drums. And then the second album the first album we did after the Pleasure EP was Great Divide. And for that, we went out to Los Angeles and we recorded at this place called American Recording Studio, which is not the same as Rick Rubin's American Recordings. It was up on Mulholland Drive way out in Topanga Canyon. Semisonic came out to LA and we stayed in Hollywood and we drove out to American and recorded all of Great Divide there. And then for Feeling Strangely Fine, we kind of wanted to bring it back home. So we did two things. We rented John Cooker, the recording legend I keep talking about. John had begun construction of this studio in downtown Minneapolis called CD Underbelly. And there was an abandoned bar next door in the same building that had not been rented or wasn't being used. It was kind of trashed. It was like a bar, and it looked like a bar that 100 people ran through and broke everything and knocked it all on the ground, including like the bar itself was like off on its side, and it was a ruin. And we set up essentially a home studio space in this ruined bar next door to where Cooker was building CD Underbelly. And we made the beginnings of most of Feeling Strangely Fine in the ruined bar. And then there was a passageway between the bar and the studio. And once the studio got opened up, another thing we did during all this time was search for a producer who would come to Minneapolis and wouldn't insist that we go to LA to record. And Nick Launay was one of our favorites for the potential job of producing us, but it took some convincing to have him fly out to Minneapolis and check out the studio that was being built. But when Nick Launay got to Minneapolis and we brought him to CD Underbelly and he looked around and he saw the outboard gear that they had and the selection of microphones, the preamps, what the board was, he was like, this is great. I totally want to record here. So we did this kind of hybrid thing with Feeling Strangely Fine, where some of the songs were done where the trio would perform live in the big studio and Nick would capture that and maybe edit two takes together. And then we would split off into two teams. Usually it was John and Jake in the ruined bar home studio with a duplicate digital 8-track recordings from the 2-inch analog recordings that we were doing in the big studio. So they would go off and do wild experiments and make crazy sounds and generate a kind of electronic ambience around things that we, for some reason, and I'm happy we did, we thought was important that it not all be a documentary of organic instruments happening. And then I did a lot of singing in the main studio with Nick, kind of coaching me and telling me that was great, do it again, until we got the right vibe with the vocals. Then the last Semisonic album, we went full DIY and recorded it mostly in a rehearsal space, with some exceptions of going to a big studio and getting something that we couldn't capture. For example, there was a beautiful 9-foot Yamaha piano in downtown Minneapolis at a place called Creation Studio. And so we cut a few of the piano tracks there. You know, we would kind of take advantage of other studios in the area to get something that needed a big ambience or an instrument that we didn't have. But most of All About Chemistry was done in the do-it-yourself manner in our rehearsal space with our live engineer, Brad Kern.
with something like Closing Time, which you've spoken in the past that it was written relatively fast in like half an hour, and you spent some time after that trying to figure out how to replicate that sort of thing, and it kind of eluded you. You have songwriting prowess and thousands of songs under your belt to sort of speak to that, and yet you haven't been able to replicate another Closing Time. And I'm wondering, do you feel like that song was a fluke, or do you feel like there was an intersection of songwriting and production and recording that perhaps you've never been able to recapture since then?
That song is one of my favorite songs that I've ever written. I love it as a piece of poetry or pop culture or whatever you want to call it. And I also think that the band was pretty hot from lots and lots of touring at the time, so we really could play. And then Nick Launay knew what to do sonically, and also maybe knew how to make sure that we didn't make things too perfect in a way, get too fussy. So I think in a way, yeah, I think that's a track that maybe a lot of the best things about that band were captured in one place. It's interesting because like I feel like Someone Like You by me and Adele was a kind of a similar confluence of things. It was the right day and the right piano and the right time for us to write a song and the right, you know, we had a couple of really just hilarious conversations before we started writing, and somehow the openness and the ambition and the great sound of that grand piano at Harmony Studios in LA was just all it took. It was all we needed. And in a way, I feel like that song is also a thing that I'll never be able to recreate, because that was a moment. It wasn't an object that I chiseled out of marble. It was a thing that happened on that day. So I feel like a bunch of times in my life I've ended up making these things where you'd think that the wise approach would be to try to do it again and again, the same thing, but it's not possible. You have to find something else to do instead. And that's so I think with Closing Time, also interestingly, Closing Time was my effort to take a second try at a couple of the songs on Great Divide, the previous album. There was one called If I Run that I thought was really good, and people didn't like it that much. And I thought, okay, something's wrong with this song, but I think the basics are correct, and I'm going to try them again on something. And I ended up trying them again on Closing Time. But I think if the original one, if that song If I Run had been like a huge smash, I don't think I would have had the same good fortune in trying to recreate it, because then I would be in a kind of a precious mode of like trying to win the lottery again. It's just crazy.
So I think about 3 or 4 years after the breakout success with Closing Time, you guys decided to break up. How much did that have to do with the lack of commercial success, perhaps, from All About Chemistry?
Well, there were a lot of reasons that we stopped. I would say we could have bounced back from the from All About Chemistry not succeeding. That was me saying I want to go more towards keyboards, and I want to have a lot of piano, and let's use, you know, synths and do something more flowery. And I think that was, it's ill-timed with the way that things were going musically in the wider world. The world of alternative music was going more and more towards, you know, super harsh, loud and angry sounds. And then we just didn't have, that wasn't what we were into at that time. And I think we could have bounced back from that. And I think we could have found a label to try another album with us. But maybe two or three factors. One, Trip Shakespeare had been on tour for about 7 years with a big amount of shows happening in the fourth, fifth, and sixth year when we really became able to tour the whole country and play lots of gigs. So Trip Shakespeare had been on the road half the year for most of 7 years. And then Semisonic, we took about a year to regroup and figure things out and try things. Then we started doing shows again. And then that band toured for about 8 years, maybe more. And the first couple of years of that was not intensive, but then it was half the year, like for the next 6 years, let's say. And, you know, that's a lot of time on the road. If you're sort of in a certain point in your life, if you're like, if you've got something to prove, and then you prove it, and then you prove it again, and then you've been on tour for, you know, 15 years or more, proving it is less of a motivation. And I think that was kind of a big part of what happened to Semisonic, that I didn't feel like I had that much more to prove. And the final thing was I had, at that time, my wife Diane and I had a daughter who was very disabled, and she needed 24-hour nursing until she was three. and she was on a tracheostomy to breathe until she was three. And she had feeding tube in her stomach until she was seven. She had a lot of very intense medical needs, and being on tour for half the year just became impossible. The ups and downs of Coco, my daughter, were so intense and frightening. And a couple times I remember I was in Germany and Diane called me one time and said, you know, Coco's back in the hospital. And after a couple of those, I was like, I can't be away all the time anymore. And that was pretty decisive in the end, I think. Just how that wore away at my spirit was pretty intense.
So I've heard that your first external songwriting gig from the band was writing with New Zealand's Bic Runga in 99. And that was because you told your publishing company that you wanted to write for other artists and they went and put that together?
One of the things that I didn't really explain or talk about very much in those days was that I really had started out when I was like 10, 11, 12. I learned about Carole King and I really wanted to be Carole King. I really wanted to be the source of songs for other people. And then just in scenes, you know, in music scenes, it's hard to like write a song for someone else. Everyone's trying to discover themselves, you know, everyone's trying to find themselves in a scene. And so all the scenes I was in my 20s, which I loved being part of a, you know, music community, but those were all full of people who were desperately trying to figure out how to even write a song on their own at all. And so I found myself in a situation where I had to start bands in order to be a songwriter because I needed to have somebody play my songs. And it wasn't going to be, I lived in Minneapolis. So, you know, I wasn't going to be pitching songs in Los Angeles and New York, and I had no money to fly there anyway. So the logical thing was to be in bands. But I always sort of thought of the bands as like a vehicle for my songs. In 98 and 99, closing time had become so huge. I think people started to think, oh, this guy Dan can write a song. And I ended up in sessions with a couple of people. I ended up in a session with Bic Runga. And I had a kind of a half-finished song. And we finished it together. And it turned out great. It was really, I mean, I love the way Good Morning Baby turned out. Then the next year, or maybe 6 months after that, my publisher, John Tita, set me up for a writing session with Carole King herself. I think he knew that I was a big fan. And I think she had heard Closing Time, and he and they were friends. And he just said, what do you think? Write a song with Dan Wilson, the guy who did Closing Time. And she said, sure, yeah, let's do it. So I had this really, my second sort of non-band songwriting session with Carole King, which was like just the most insightful masterclass type of experience I could have ever wanted, with someone that I trusted utterly. Like anything she said, I would believe it because I loved so many of her songs and I was such a crazy fan. So everything she said, I was super open to. And the way she went about collaboration, I like absorbed the whole thing like really, really intently. I wasn't like, it wasn't a scheme of mine to work with Carole King so I could absorb her knowledge. It was literally like, okay, I'm going to write a song with Carole King. Great. And when I ended up in proximity with her, I learned all this stuff that I didn't know I was even wanting to learn. It was amazing.
John Tita, of course, unfortunately passed. He was well known on the sort of songwriter side. What publishing company were you signed to with him?
John was our first A&R at Warner Chappell Publishing. And Trip Shakespeare never had a publishing deal. And Semisonic, we waited as long as we could. And then when it became apparent that we were going to be broke for a couple more years than we could stand it any longer, we signed a publishing deal with Warner Chappell. And John he was like the greatest person to have a meeting in a hotel room after a gig. He was just the most, at a time when everyone else would be super tired or out of it in some way or another, he was just a sort of a beacon of like excitement and focus. And I just have memories of, whoa, this guy who's worked with really impressive people is like hanging out in our hotel room till all hours talking about music. I just loved it.
So what I noticed is that even the first song that you did with Bic ended up on the American Pie soundtrack, and you've had quite a few soundtrack appearances over the years. Dear John, Twilight, Fault in Our Stars, Big Little Lies on the TV side. What is the pipeline that's taking so many of your songs into these movies and shows? Is that John and Warner Chappell, or was that something else?
I feel like if I assessed how many times I tried to write a song for a movie and how many movies used the song, it would seem like quite a failure. Like so many times a movie person has met with me and like shown me the recent cut of the movie or whatever. And then I've gotten so excited and I've written a bunch of songs and then they just never call you back. You know, it's just a funny LA thing. The ones that you listed, I think sometimes it has to do with the person commissioning the songs for the movie and if they happen to be my fan. I think sometimes if they just trust that my songs have an emotional power to them, or my songs will serve the picture, I'm already kind of in their thoughts because they've already loved other music of mine, you know. I don't think it's a pipeline you can find before you've written 500 songs, but if you've written 500 songs, then maybe this is a pipeline and maybe you can find this pipeline if it really is a pipeline. I've never had the sensation that I just wrote a song and it sailed into a movie. It's always been, oh yeah, they decided not to use it. Oh, they decided to put it back in. Oh, it's out again. You know, it's like, it's never been like, oh, Dan, you know, you've got the rubber stamp, you're in, you know, whatever. It's more like, we might not, you know, it's all very iffy. And I've kind of learned over time to like pretty much ignore that side of the business and really only think in terms of like, are they asking to use one of my songs in a really kind of offensive and horrible way? And do I have the leverage to say, no, I really would be mad if you did that. That's a bummer. I don't want to watch a murder while one of my songs is playing. You know, some people that might be fun for them to in a movie. So it's like for them, that would be like, oh, Dan, why did you turn that down? That seems like a fun thing. But I just have specific little things that I don't want my songs to be connected to. And maybe that's my generally for self-preservation's sake. I'm not super into like desperately hoping that some song of mine will get in a movie.
So in terms of ending up in rooms with these artists and doing co-writes, how much of that is you approaching people directly versus them coming to you versus a publisher just sort of orchestrating things to make it happen?
A certain amount of my co-writes come from me being fan of the artist, and some of them come from the artist being a fan of me. And quite often, those two things happen at the same time. And it's not like I always think of, I don't sit around and make lists of people that I want to write songs with, although it might be a smart idea for me to do, but I just am following the thread of like whatever I'm working on right now. And then either I will be talking to my manager or my publisher and say, you know whose records I love is so-and-so. And then they always have the smart and the thing that for some reason I don't have, that they always say, oh, well, I'll contact their management and see if they wanted to work with you. And I go, whoa, what a great idea. I didn't think of that. I think because when I'm a fan, like when I have my fan hat on, I'm not thinking this is somebody I could jam with. I'm thinking, oh my God, this person is so amazing. You know, I don't immediately say they need some of what I have to offer, you know. But so I think it's somewhat generated by, or friends of friends. Like I first wrote with Rachel Yamagata because her manager was an ex-A&R guy of mine. And we had a great time. And then she introduced me to Jason Mraz, who was a friend of hers, and said, you got to hang out with Dan Wilson and write some songs. And so he came to Minneapolis and we wrote a bunch of songs. Sometimes it happens in that way. Stapleton and I sang together at an In the Round performance for an ASCAP Songwriter Expo in LA about 10 years ago. And his songs just like blew my mind. He sang before me in the round. So I had to sing right after him every time he played his mind-blowingly, emotionally brilliant song. And so I was so amazed and impressed by him. And then that actually also because Adele had shown me a clip of Chris singing If It Hadn't Been for Love in a state fair, you know, those semi-trailer sheds where they lift up one side and it's a stage, you know? So he was playing If It Hadn't Been for Love in a stage like that. And Adele showed me that in a session. And so then when I met Chris Songwriter Expo, I was already a fan. I'm pretty sure that's how it all lined up. And I had already had plans to go down to New Orleans and write with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. And I asked Chris to come along if he wants to write with me in the Pres Hall Jazz Band. And we didn't even know each other at that point. But he said, well, as long as you know, Dan, that I don't know the first thing about jazz, I'll write some songs with you with them. So we went down and basically made a very fun and useful, somewhat, collection of songs in New Orleans for, better part of a week. And then every time he was back in LA for several years, he would stop by my place and we'd write a song. So that's how we wrote White Horse, his hit from last year. We wrote that like 8-9 years ago, something like that, maybe more. As just part of a, hey, we're hanging out. We met by happenstance and a friend introduced me to your music and here we are.
And in terms of some of the more notable credits that you have with like Adele and the Dixie Chicks, that came through Rick Rubin, him bringing you in?
I'm sure my publisher had been sort of pitching me as a possible collaborator for the Chicks for a long time. But he and I were working on my solo album, Free Life, together. So Rick was knee deep in my songs. And so when he was talking with the Chicks about songs that they could do on a record, you know, cover on a record, he played them several of mine. And initially the plan was for them to just cover Sugar and Free Life and a couple of the songs that I had written. But then they started to maybe think that it'd be better for them to just write all the songs for the album. And then Rick waved the flag of them getting together with me. And because they had already had this plan of cutting my songs, you know, it was an easy mental leap for them to just go, oh, let's, yeah, if Dan will come to LA, let's write some songs with Dan instead of just sing some songs by Dan. So that's how that happened. And then with Adele, I'm pretty sure that the business was trying to get us in touch because I was a huge fan of Hometown Glory and Chasing Pavements. Then Rick got involved and he was very into the idea of Adele and me writing together because of the great time we had had working on the Dixie Chicks. And that got canceled a few times on my part, like songwriter scheduling problems and on her part, kind of, who knows, issues that, you know, or better things came along. You never know. But each time Adele and I had a session planned and then it got canceled, Rick would sort of float back in and say, I really think you and Dan should do a couple of songs together. I really think it would be great if you guys wrote together. So I think it was him kind of gently but very firmly, like, not letting it the idea go away. He just had an instinct about it, you know.
And if you know how to articulate it, or if you can put your finger on it, what is your skill as a songwriter that people are tapping you for? Because you're kind of writing for people with voices that are sometimes very different than yours. So what are they bringing you in to contribute? Is it like the singer-songwriter sensitivity thing, the subtle lyrics thing, the top line thing? Like, what are they after from you?
Well, I don't think most artists, including me, are really great at analyzing what they're missing. So I don't think people go into these collaborations with a brilliantly thought out sense of what they don't bring to the table. Unless it's like, I can't play an instrument, I need someone to play the piano. Or unless it's like, I can only write a song to a beat, so I need to find someone who makes great beats on the fly. Mostly, I think artists don't have a sense of what someone else could bring to a collaboration that they lack. Do you know what I mean? So I don't think it's that. I think it's more like either fandom of some kind, or respect, or even like a kind of aura that is around someone's success. I'm sure I've been in a lot of sessions where people knew that I wrote Someone Like You with Adele, and they had no idea what about Someone Like You would be good for them to have in one of their own songs, but they have such an emotional relationship to that song that their stance is more like, yeah, I'd love to get together with him. Every once in a while, I'll end up in things where somebody will reference the thing that I did before and say, like, maybe I talked to an A&R person, then they would say, we really need something like White Horse by Stapleton, something with a big guitar, blah, blah, blah. And sadly for me, don't tell any A&R people this, but this usually ends up with me writing sort of the opposite of White Horse by Chris Stapleton in some way. It's a slow jam or something, you know? So I think that even if people are taking a kind of a scientific approach to like, well, you know, we'll put you together with so-and-so because they will bring the power ballad that you need. I think that that works less often for me than someone just going, I think you will enjoy a couple afternoons with Dan. That seems more like an indicator to me. I think another thing people look for, I do think one thing people look for from me is that I almost don't want to say this, but like, I think I'm just kind of a good example of how to be an artist and roll with punches and not give up and be optimistic and love people. And I once read this interview with T-Bone Burnett in Tape Op magazine. And T-Bone Burnett said in this interview, and I was kind of annoyed at it actually at first. He said, I think my first job as a producer is to love the people I'm working with. And when I read that, my defensive or cynical or dumb side of my personality was like, ah, that's bullshit. You know, that's not the first job. And then I kind of over weeks, I would think about that quote once in a while, and I'd be like, wait a minute, maybe that is the first job, is just to love somebody. And maybe sometimes I feel like, and I'm not saying people are doing sessions with me because I will love them. All I mean is, I think that stance is a very low pressure stance. You're like, if I do a session with you and it's just, I'm just loving what you do and, you know, learning about you as a human being and like really digging it and tossing out a couple ideas, you know, it might even be that the thing that happens, like I get this a lot. Oh, Dan, that session was so great. I left your studio and during the next week, I wrote 7 songs and they're all great. And to me, that's like a huge win. That's like a big deal for me. But my business arm, you know, the people that I work with might find that kind of annoying sometimes. Oh, Dan, working with Dan gave them some sort of freedom to go off and write a whole bunch of songs alone. But I think that's like, to me, that's a huge win just on a human level. And I don't, you can't monetize most of the things in life that are worth doing. So music is the same.
A lot of your songs, when you go through the discography, a lot of them have this sort of what people associate with a singer-songwriter kind of mold to them, whether it's the sole acoustic guitar on the vocal or the sole piano on the vocal or like sparse instrumentation and sort of sensitive lyrics and singing. And whilst that has been sort of a staple sound of the last 20, 30 years of singer-songwriter stuff, I think the contemporary pop landscape since, 2011, 2012 has kind of shifted because EDM came along, had its sort of 2-3 years and then just got fused into pop. And now it's all about either beats inspired by EDM or beats inspired by hip hop, take your pick. And it's, that's kind of what people associate with hit records nowadays. And a lot of other stuff gets pushed by the wayside. How does your positioning get affected by something like that? Or are you sort of insulated by your past success that there's always going to be a place for you?
I don't think I have a great answer for that because the first thing I thought of when you were describing what you're describing was a whole bunch of singer-songwriters that are working now. So I think my view of the world probably affects what I even notice in the world to some degree. But like, for example, I've been a fan of A.G. Cook for a long time. And nobody really is looking for me to be A.G. Cook in anybody's life. It's just, that's not why they would ask me to do a session to provide, bleeps and bloops on an arpeggiated synthesizer and banging beats. That's just not what I'm called for. But I do those things on my own just for fun. And I listen to Danielle Harrell's productions and A.G. Cook's productions and a bunch of the stuff on the Brat album is stuff that I probably wouldn't be associated with. And I don't have any connection to the people who made that Charlie XCX album. But I feel like I could easily imagine somebody in that kind of camp getting curious and having me in for a song. And it happens often enough. But, it is true. Like a lot of my songs are kind of, the lyrics are near the front. It's not about ultra efficient electronic programming for me. But I guess I love music and I kind of continue to hope people will want to jam with me because I like to make music.
What does your home studio setup look like?
It looks like a living room with some instruments lying around. It's really not a studio. I do have a pedal board with a whole bunch of guitar effects on it because I like to make tracks for people's albums on the guitar and I think it's fun to make experimental wild sounds on the guitar. But I don't really have like racks of synthesizers or, anything like that. I got a very minimal setup.
What's your choice of guitar acoustically?
Acoustically, I love the a Gibson Southern Jumbo. I have a couple of Gibson acoustics. I've got a J50 that's really beautiful. I don't really love Martins very much. I like Gibsons. Electric guitars, I like an SG or a more Gibsons. I like an SG or a Les Paul. And I have a Gretsch Duo Jet, a reissue of early 70s Gretsch Duo Jet that is the first thing I grab when I'm playing guitar these days.
And what are you recording into? What's your DAW of choice?
I can do, I'm sort of barely okay on Logic and pretty good on Ableton and, digital native on Pro Tools.
Nice. No, I'm not surprised about the Pro Tools prominence.
Well, Pro Tools is like Ableton sounds awesome when everything has been modified in an Ableton way. If everything in the track has been slowed down, sped up, formanted, pitched up and down, Ableton sounds amazing. And if you do all that with Pro Tools, it sounds terrible. But if you're just recording raw things and presenting them in a kind of a frontal way, then Pro Tools is hard to beat. It's hard to beat for drum recording.
So one thing I do wonder is that, in the aftermath of Semisonic's recent album, which kind of took 20 years since the last one, the times have obviously changed. And even though you guys probably still have the same fan base, even though they might be a little older and new people have rediscovered your stuff, and you do relatively well on streaming. The days of that kind of success, just because you had success 20 years ago, seems to kind of be past us, where it's now about an online presence and virality and TikTok and stuff. So with your latest album, just logistically not having the ability to reach the heights of your previous albums, how do you feel about that last release, and what does it mean for the future of Semisonic?
Well, let's see. We didn't really think that the album would be a hit or be on, you know, be a charting success. We just really, really wanted to make one. And it led to some really beautiful things. It led to, you know, last year we played 30 shows or something like that. That's a lot for us. And this year we went to Mexico City and played a festival, and that was great. And I'm currently writing songs for Semisonic to try to make another recording of some kind, because I really want to do that. And he and John and Jake also want to do that. So it's hard to think in terms of like how to, I mean, when you talk about TikTok and virality, most people who have a viral hit on TikTok don't have another one. And so you can't really think in terms of like how to recreate your past successes in the current climate, because many, many young singers are out there having had one viral hit that now they're on this kind of hopeless quest to go viral a second time. Generally, it's not likely. So I guess if that's the reality, then the TikTok wise, the best thing that could ever happen to Semisonic is for us to have one viral clip that becomes huge. And then 6 months later, we'd be in the same position of like, you know, what do? We haven't been able to go viral again. And it becomes, you're chasing your tail. So my thing now is like, what would be inspiring and what would be joyful and what would get me back together with my friends? And those three questions are easily answered by at least one thing, which is do some more recordings with Semisonic and try to play shows. So that's kind of where it's at for me right now. So many of the things that have gone well for me have seemed flukish and unexpected and, you know, out of the blue. And I just have come to believe that you can't force that to happen. You just have to make stuff that you find inspiring, and you have to almost leave a trail of music that, you know, that you're not worried too much about.
Indeed. Well, this was nice. Thank you, Dan, for taking the time.
Cool, Sam. Yeah, pleasure.